Good to see everybody. Wonderful. I have to tell you, give you a tremendous compliment. I semi-consciously didn't send out an email reminder today. I thought of it in the morning. I said, oh, I should really send out a reminder. And then when the afternoon came and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I want to see who's really committed to this, who has it on their calendar, who's going to be here tonight. So kudos to all of you, my diehards. You guys are the best. So here we are. Special, special, special share about insights for our Passover Seder. It's coming up Monday night. A lot of great insights, so many beautiful ideas to share about the holiday of Pesach, of Passover. Tonight, I'm only going to focus on one section of the Haggadah, one tiny section that I think will be mind-blowing, number one. And number two, the second half is completely new for me. Absolutely. I had never even thought about it, never put connecting the dots. I'm very excited. And I'm going to share it, God willing, at my Seder. So you already have a leg up on those at my Seder. Okay. What do I want to focus on? I want to focus on the fact that the theme of the Pesach Seder, whatever you want to focus on, is always done in a question and answer format. What I mean by that is very simple. I mentioned to one of my groups this week that I have a custom that I come into the Seder after everybody is sitting there already, everybody's gathered, and I come in with some weird, wacky costume, something really extraordinarily weird. That's my custom. And people ask, why, Rabbi, are you doing that? Or, Zadie, what are you doing? And I look at them and I smile and I'm so excited. Why? Because at that moment, I have now done the mitzvah of engaging my child in let's have a conversation about why we're here tonight. It sounds crazy, but that's what we have to do. Child is asking, we're trying to give answers. Adults are asking, we're trying to have a discussion, but it's in a question answer format. It's not like you guys are subjected every Wednesday night to a lecture that just goes on and on and on. This is meant to be interactive. It's meant to be involved and with questions and answers. There's a lot of discussion in Judaic literature as to why that is. From a very practical standpoint, and it has been shown numerous times with various studies and educational institutions that I shouldn't say children, people learn best in a question and answer format. People do not do well with lectures. They will only absorb a certain amount, and their attention and their focus will wane. It will focus on other things, get distracted, and there's only so much they can absorb. But if it's a question and answer, it's a constant resetting because you're re-engaging every time there's another question or there's another answer. It's been shown with many studies. So the night of the Seder, which I've said many, many times, is the preeminent night of the year that we focus on making sure that we give over our traditions to the next generation. Makes a lot of sense that we do it in a question and answer format. So the obvious, you have two sections that really focus on questions and answers. The famous one is the Ma Nishtana, where with a child, typically the youngest child, although it doesn't have to be. In fact, the Talmud says that it has to be questions that are asked. The four questions of the Ma Nishtana need to be asked, even if there are no children around the table, and even if it's just husband and wife, and even if it's a person all by themselves, they should ask the questions and give the answers. That is the format. So we come to the Ma Nishtana and we have the four questions. Why is this night different than all other nights? And we all know the questions. We're not going to go through it. That's one section, which we will come back to shortly. But there's another section in the Haggadah, also with four questions, and it's referring to the four children. The four children, the four sons, they call it, but I don't know why it's limited to sons. It's four children, and that ask their particular question. And what are they? The Haggadah delineates and says, the Chacham, the wise child, asks a very sophisticated question of what are the statutes and the laws and the different testimonies that God has commanded you. And we talk about all these different things. Then comes the wicked child, which if you've attended my class in the past, you know, that's my favorite guy. I love the wicked one. He's my favorite, hands down. The wise one, pass him off to somebody else. The simple one, I'll deal with that. But the one I love is the wicked child. Love him. Okay? What's his question? His question is, what is this service to you? Ma ha'avoda hazot lachem. What is this service to you? And he says it in a snarky voice with his hands on his hip and like, ah, who needs all this stuff? Okay? We'll come back to him. The third child is the Tam, the simple one who asks simply, Mazot, what is all of this? I'm not sophisticated like my brother, who's the wise kid, who has all the different delineations of statutes and laws and testimonies. I don't know from all this. I just want to know what is up with this tonight. And then you have the fourth child who doesn't even know what to ask. She'ena yodea lishol, doesn't know to ask, either because too young, their brain hasn't matured, they're very young children, or, if I can be so bold, doesn't know to ask because it's brand new. Doesn't even know what to ask. It's just overwhelming. It might be their very first Seder. Never had it before. And everything is just, what? Can't even get out a question. These are the four children. Okay? So bear with me. The Chacham, the wise child, I think that's relatively straightforward. The wise child, as the name implies, you can hear from his question that he's asking a sophisticated question. He wants to know what's the difference between statutes and testimonies and laws. You know, there's different kinds of mitzvot. Why are we doing all these so many? There's no other night of the year, ladies and gentlemen, other than Seder night that has mitzvot like that. There is no other night on the calendar that is bombarded with mitzvot like Seder night. And the Chacham, the wise child, wants to know why. What's up with all the different things we're doing and the ceremonies and the leaning and the dippings and salt water, but matzah and that? What? There's a lot going on here. The wicked child says, what is this service to you? Now, I want you to listen carefully. Picture the following scene. Rabbi and Mrs. T are sitting at their Friday night Shabbat dinner, and we have company. Company we've never had before. It happens probably once a week. So we have them there. And of course, I do my thing. I make Kiddush. And what happens? My custom is I fill up my cup and I stand and everybody stands with me and I say the first part. And then I sit down in the middle and I make the blessings and everybody sits down. It's like, Rabbi, I don't mean to be bold or anything, but why are you doing what you're doing? Why did you stand here and sit there? Good question. Hold that thought, Jack. Fine. Let's go wash our hands. Oh, I already washed my hands before dinner. You told me we were having dinner. No. We're going to ritually wash it. Okay. And why do we do that? We'll explain. Don't worry. Here's what I want you. Take the cup, fill it all the way to the brim, because, you know, we want to be wealthy, so we want as much water as possible. And you pour it on your right hand twice. No, you know, let's do it three times. And then I want you to switch and do it again on the left hand. And then I want you to raise it up, cup your hands, make a blessing. Okay. Why are you doing this, Rabbi? And then we get to Hamotzi. I say, shh. I washed. I can't talk, you know? So fine. So I take the challah and I put one on top of the other and I lift it up. And then I take it and I cut it. I cut off the end. I dip it in salt, and then I'm getting like, what are you doing? And we haven't even gotten to the fish yet or the meatballs. Can you imagine the phrase that comes out of their mouths, something along the lines of, Rabbi, what are you doing? Why are you doing these things? Is that a fair question? Yes. Do you find that that's a sincere question? I think so. Very sincere. So I'm going to ask you, in the words that the wicked son says, Ma ha'avoda Hazot Lachem. What is this service to you? How do you know he's being snarky? How do you know that he's being sarcastic? Watch. I'm going to say it exactly the same words, two different ways. Watch. We'll do the snarky way first. That's more exciting. Why are you doing all of this? What is this service to you? Versus, why are you doing this? What is the service that you're doing? Exact same words. The first time is extremely rude and arrogant and snarky. And he does have his hands on his hips when he says it. The second version, exact same words, sounds very sincere. So I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, how do you know this kid is asking it in a terrible way that we brand him not you have, you know, needs improvement, what they said on my report card? That's just a soft way of saying, oh, Lord, I can't wait till he moves on to the next grade. Right? What? How do you know from those words, what is this service to you? I can ask it in a very sincere way. Rabbi, what is this thing you're doing? He doesn't say, what is this thing we're doing? I get this question all the time. How do you know he's being insincere? That we brand him as wicked, evil. You never brand a child like that. You do? Susan, you brand a child evil?
No, I was just thinking that it's about, I would never do that. And also, but it's about tone. It is about,
so how can you tell, how can you tell tone of voice in the written word?
No, you cannot. Of course you cannot.
How do you know?
We can't.
So why does the author of the Haggadah call him wicked?
I have no clue.
Well, that's my question. Yes, Michelle.
I think that this is not a stranger at the table. This is a son, and he is removing himself from the family.
How do you know that?
Because he says, "What is it to you, not to us?"
I just gave you an exact example, Michelle. I purposely chose the words, Rabbi. What are you doing? Not what we're doing. What is this service you're doing, Rabbi?
But he
same words.
You're saying it, Rabbi.
Forget the rabbi. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? I get this question all the time. Why are you doing that? Those are the words. How do you know that he's being insincere?
I feel that he's part of the family and he's separating himself from the family.
You have read the Haggadah too many times. Stop reading it. You have been brainwashed. You are conditioned because you have read this literally 100 times, if not more. You are conditioned to say that. I'm asking you just from the words. Remember, the only words that are quoted of his question are 4 words. Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem. What is this service to you? I can say it in the most gentle, soft tone, sincere manner. Go ahead, Robin. Save me.
But no, I'm not saving you at all. I'm confused. Why is that different than what the simple child though? If he's not doing it in a snarky tone, then how is that different than the simple child?
The simple child just asked 2 words. He just says mazo. What is this?
Okay, but that sounds very similar to what this child is.
Well, Michelle's point is well taken, and that is he does add, "What is this service to you?" He's asking. Michelle is right. He does give the impression that he's not a part of it. But I'm only asking it as I get this question, and you have also. All of you have heard that. Why are you doing this? Do they really mean to exclude themselves? They're asking because they don't do it. They're asking because you're doing it. How do you know this kid is so insincere? The answer is we can go on and on and on for hours, and we will not come to an answer until you get one more piece of information that I have purposely left out. Right? Because I want you to ask the question and then you'll appreciate the answer. I'm going to share with you, as you all figured out, these 3 children who do ask questions, obviously the 4th doesn't ask, are all taken straight out of psukim, out of verses in the Torah itself. This isn't a made-up question. The Torah itself says, and if your child will say to you, a child will ask you, what is this? I'm going to show you the actual verses that bring down these questions. But ladies and gentlemen, I don't want you to focus on the question. I want you to focus on how the Torah introduces the question. Very important. You with me? You have your, you got it? You have your challenge? Okay, here we go. I'm going to share my screen and we're going to start with, which one are we going to start with?
That's the wise son, Deuteronomy 6.
Yeah, it is. Right, one second. Okay.
You want Exodus 12, 26.
I got it. I have three tabs open. Have no fear. Okay? Here we go. Verse 20. Ki yishalcha bincha machar lemar. When, in the time to come, your children ask you, what mean the decrees, laws, and rules that our God Hashem has enjoined upon you? This is the question, as John said, this is the question of the wise child. Please, do you see the quote? What does it mean? Forget the question. This, we know the question. Look at the words prior. When, in a time to come, your children ask you. Hold that. Hold that right there. I'm going to show you a different one. Can you see the new one? Verse 14. Did it change?
Yeah.
Yes? You all see a different one? And when in time to come, a child of yours asks you, saying, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to make this bigger?
No, see it.
You do see it or you don't see it?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, fine. So you see, and this is the simple child. What does this mean? Mazot, what is this? But again, focus on the introduction. And when in a time to come, a child of yours asks you, saying. Let's compare it to one other. Let's compare it to the wicked child. Verse 25. And when your children ask you, what do you mean by this right? You see that? I need to point out a major mistake in this translation. Major.
Children.
This is incorrect. And I'll show you why. I want you to look at this word right here. The word yomru. Ki yomru aleichem. Let me close this. I'm going to make this a little bigger. You need to see this with your own two eyes. Here we go. You see the one I highlighted right here?
Uh-huh.
The haya, yeah. And it will be ki when yomru aleichem b'neichem. When your children, what does the word amar, vayomer? The word amar means said, says.
Okay.
When your children will say to you, what do you mean by this right? Mahavoda azot lachem. Let's contrast that. What's this word? And it will be, right? This is the simple child. And at time to come, a child of yours asks. Yish'olcha, the word she'ela means to ask. A question. A she'ela is a question. And it will be when your child will ask you. Let's look at one more. Let's look at the wise child. And it will be ki yish'olcha, when your child will ask you. Do you see the difference?
Yes.
The wise child and the simple child, the Torah's word for quote unquote, the question is the word will ask you.
Ask.
If you look back at the wicked child, it says, Yomru Aleichem, when your child will say to you, what is this service to you? Oh, now we're talking. Now we can understand. How do I know that he's not being sincere? Because he's not asking a question. He's stating his rhetorical question. You've all been in meetings where somebody wants to state their agenda, but they're not, they don't have the chutzpah to say it outright. So what they do is they quote, ask a question, but there's no question being asked. It's rhetorical, right? When you read a story or you hear somebody tell you over something and you go, really? Question mark? What does that mean? Really? I doubt what you're saying is true, but I don't want to call you a liar. So I'm just going to ask, really? If the person who is not asking a real question sincerely, he's stating a question. What is this service to you? You see that? See, I don't like, this is incorrect. This translation has when your children ask you, it is not. The Hebrew word is yomru. When your child will say to you, what is this service to you? He's not asking a question. This is the world of difference. This is a massive difference. You know how the author of the Haggadah knows that he's wicked? Because he read the Torah. And the Torah introduced the quote-unquote question, what is this service to you? Not with the word that should be, your child will ask you. It's introduced when your child will say to you, what is this service to you? That's how you know it's snarky. Hands on, what is this service to you? That's not a question. That's a statement. Now all bets are off. Number one rule, and I tell this to every Shabbaton, every time I do an Ask the Rabbi session, my number one rule is you can ask anything you want. Can't promise I'll know the answer, but you have the right to ask anything that bothers you, anything that you're curious about. I don't care. One condition, it has to be a sincere question that you're willing to open up your mind to hear a possible answer. If you've already made up your mind and this is the only way that you can view it, then you're not asking me a question. You're stating your agenda. I can't answer an answer. Maybe I can answer a question. This child is wicked because he's not willing to ask a question to hear a possible answer. He's made up his mind. This whole thing is so ridiculous. Why we waste our time sitting around here, eating stuff and leaning and matzah tastes like cardboard. It's worse than rice cakes. I mean, seriously, why do we have to do all that? I have no answers. What am I going to tell him? Oh, you have to know years ago we were slaves. Oh, farfingdugan, he's going to say. If you ask a question, even if it's a simple question of, Maza, what is all of this? Great, let's have a conversation. A question that's sophisticated. Great, let's have a conversation. I don't even care if you ask a question that comes from a passion of what you don't like about it. That's fine. But you have to ask a question. That is the basic rule here. I can add to it, but I want to share with you a second part. So I want to make sure we're clear on this. Number one, that when we talk about the Seder night, about questions and answers, it has to be that we're opening our minds to ask questions and be willing to hear answers. Now we can have a conversation at the Seder. But I want to take this a little bit further. And this is what was new for me. And I love it. I really, really love it. Where is the very first question recorded in the Torah? We have a general rule. The first occurrence of anything in the Torah is the source. I'll give you an example. The letter Tet. The very first time that the letter Tet appears is the word Tov. Good. God saw that it was good. Therefore, says the Talmud, that if a person has some crazy dream and he dreams about the letter Tet, that's a sign, that's an omen for good things to happen. Now, you're all going to have dreams tonight about the letter Tet. It doesn't work that way, but nice try. But you should know that that's one of the, right? That the first time you come across something in the Torah, that's its source. So I'm asking you, what's the very first question in the Torah?
God, Hashem asks, asks Adam, because we have to go back to the Garden of Eden where he is.
Always. But that's not true.
That is not the first question?
That is not the first question in history.
Oh, man. Are we going to get to it? Will we get to the Garden of Eden, though? Or did I just slip it in? Okay, I'll be quiet.
No, we got it. Don't worry. Anybody else want to take a shot? Yes,
is
Robin.
About, like the heavens and the earths? What, the heavens and the earth?
Where's the question?
I don't know. I thought it was something like, what was the heaven and the earth? I'm not sure the question.
Somewhere
in the ballpark.
Nope.
Who made the heavens?
Himself? It is in the Garden of Eden. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Is it, should we make man in our image? I mean, should we make man? I'm trying to think if it's between God and the angels at that point. I thought there was a possible question, but maybe it was more of a statement.
It was a statement.
Yeah.
Let us make man in our image. But it wasn't a question. However, the very first question in the Garden of Eden.
Was it? Oh, okay.
Go ahead. Come on.
No, I was going to say, was it between the sun and the moon?
No. The first recorded question is when the snake asked Chava, when the snake asked Eve, did God really say not to touch the tree, not to eat from the tree? Mm. That was the enticement for her to say, yes, God said we can't do it. Really? I'll read you what it says. Now the serpent was cunning beyond any beast of the field that Hashem God had made. He said to the woman, did perhaps God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? The woman said, no, of the fruit of any tree of the garden we may eat. Of the fruit of the tree which is in the center of the garden, God said, you shall not neither eat of it nor touch it lest you die. But the opening question, did God perhaps say that you shouldn't eat from any of the trees? Is the very first recorded question in history.
It's not. Right.
This was the beginning of trouble. The beginning of trouble. Because it was the ensnarement. This was the snake's, the serpent's opportunity to get into a conversation, to plant a few seeds of doubt into Chava's mind, into Eve's mind, which then translated into her taking the fruit and giving it to her husband. The beginning of the downfall for mankind started with the snake's questioning about what did God command? Questioning God's commandment. Think about that for a moment. It has global consequence. The ripple effect is massive. Prior to the snake coming on the scene, what existed? Were there man and woman living in the Garden of Eden? The answer is yes. Were they living properly in the Garden of Eden? Yes. Was there a proper balance between physical and spiritual? Yes. Comes along the snake and starts to plant the seeds of doubt about, is there really truth to this system? Is God egotistical that he wants to retain power? And therefore he told you things, but the truth is you can be just as great. And things start to shift out of balance because of a question. What's even more impactful is what happens immediately after Adam and Eve eat from it. Now we come to Susan. Now God comes to them because they're hiding, and God begins asking questions to them.
Where are you?
Where are you is the first. Now, pause for a moment on that. We'll come more to this, but let's just, I want to paint the picture. Prior to this snake, like I said, all is balanced. There's no doubt about God. There's a perfect harmony between physical and spiritual. Adam and Eve know they are physical bodies that are invested with a spiritual soul. But now God feels the need to ask questions of them once they sin and threw things out of balance. How many questions does God ask of Adam and Eve after they sin? So you name the first one. Are there more? Hint, hint.
Yes.
Just if you had to guess, how many questions do you think God asked Adam and Eve after they sinned? Yes, Robin, you are totally yes, because the theme of the night of Seder is four questions. Now you may have another source for it, because exactly four questions God asks of Adam and Eve after they sin. What are they? We can go through them. Or you can trust me and we have it. Either way. All four. If you want to find them, it's in chapter 3. Open up your Chumash and you'll see in chapter 3 he asks four questions. The first being, where are you? Okay, I'll read it to you. I can't not do it. Okay, they heard the sound. Hashem God called out to the man and said to him, where are you? Question number one. He said, I heard the sound of you in the garden. I was afraid because I'm naked, so I hid. And God said, who told you that you are naked? Number three, have you eaten of the tree from which I commanded you not to eat? That's three. The man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. And Hashem God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? Question number four. The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. God said to the serpent, and then he goes and he punishes all three of the characters. Four questions are asked after the serpent enticed us with questions of doubt. If I can be so bold, the author of this thing that I'm sharing with you didn't make this connection, but maybe this is along the lines of the wicked son. It's not a it's a question that is breeding doubt. In the case of the wicked child, it's because he's not asking anything. He's saying, ah, fooey on all of this. But from the original question recorded in the Torah, there's doubt that has now been ingested, that's been put into the world, doubting God. So what is the antidote to that? Well, what did God do? God came and said, now I need to ask questions that will inspire you to understand your mistake and inspire you to correct it. I'm going to ask you hard questions. What's the first question that God asks of mankind? Ayeka, where are you? And all the commentaries are wondering, really? You, God, who create the entire universe and everything in it, you don't know where Adam's hiding? Really? Was it that good of a hiding place? Behind which tree could he possibly be hiding that you can't see him?
He wants them to come forward.
What?
He's asking, even though he knows, he wants them to come forward.
Correct. And that is what Rashi tells us. Rashi tells us, of course, God knew where Adam was, but he wants to give him a chance to come forward and fess up what he did wrong. That is true. But before I tell you another insight about this, I'll tell you a story. Story when I was a young boy. I don't remember the story, but my mother's told it enough times, I feel like it must have happened. The story goes that my mother took me shopping, not for me. She had, I don't know, I was a young kid, and she took along my two grandmothers. So the three ladies and me. I'm a little kid. I can't be more than, I'll say, 5, 6 years old. I'm not even sure I was that old. Maybe 4 or 5 years old. Fine, we're in a department store. And my mother says to my grandmothers, do you mind watching Tzvi just for a couple of minutes? I want to go return something. I want to go, I don't know, whatever it was. Sure, no problem. Two grandmothers, one little punk, no problem. Not a moment after they say that, my mother leaves, they look, and I'm nowhere to be found. Gone. Now, nowadays, unfortunately, that you conjure up terrible things. But back then, you didn't think about that. But they're frantic. They're like, where could he possibly be? And they're looking and they're looking and they're looking and they cannot find me. At this point, maybe 10 minutes later, my mother comes back and you can just see the look on my grandmother's faces. Oy vey, right? As they would say, verminishgit. Oy vey, bad news, okay? Well, we can't find him. I don't know what happened. My mother says, calm down. Where's the last place you saw him? It was near the furniture here. I don't know. Fine. So she starts looking under the bed. She starts looking here and there. And he sees a dresser and she starts opening up the drawers, you know, and of course in the bottom drawer, pulls it out. And I look up and I say, you found me. is this really what happened in the Garden of Eden? Adam was hiding in the bottom drawer so God shouldn't see him? Can't be. Can't be. The Midrash tells us that the word Ayeka, where are you, was a question. What happened to you? What happened? Where is the creature that in the entire history of the universe, no one else had a distinction of being created by God? Adam was not born by a woman. The only one in history formed out of God's hands, so to say. Where are you? You were on such a high, lofty level where physicality and spirituality were in perfect harmony. You knew who I was. You knew about commandments. You had it all. Where are you? What's happened? You have sunken so far that you're hiding from me? Ayeka, what happened? Where are you spiritually? Do you not see how you've fallen from such a level? He was trying to inspire him to change, to see the fallacy of his mistakes. The Baal HaTanya, the author of the Tanya, one of the earliest works in Chabad, tells us that this question that God asked Adam of Ayeka, where are you? What happened to the person that I created? Is asked of each of us in every generation. We are asked that question. Where are you? Where are you holding? I gave you such abilities. I gave you such talents. I gave you a curiosity to want to learn more. Where are you? It's a little rebuke. Okay, a lot rebuke. But that's what Adam was being told. God was asking him, where are you? This is the first of four questions that Hashem asked of Adam and Chav, of Adam and Eve. And this author of this idea that I read was suggesting that that is why at the Seder we ask four questions to rectify the mistake of what happened with this tree of knowledge of good and evil that they partook of. The same way that God showed us the way to rectify that actual mistake, after going against the command and eating from that tree, we, every night at the Seder, every year at the Seder, we ask four questions to remind ourselves, are we doing what we're supposed to do? Have we done our part to rectify that mistake? Or am I continuing to do that mistake as well? It's interesting that the numerical value of the words Eitz Hadat, the tree of knowledge, is the same numerical value as the word chametz and se'ar. Chametz, obviously, is the leavened bread that we don't eat on Pesach, and se'ar is the yeast. That's the leavening agent. The way to correct, stay away from chametz and se'ar. Stay away from it so that we can rectify the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge. But I want to show you that this is the same scenario with a different episode in another story that you're familiar with. Let's fast forward. Let's introduce ourselves to a man by the name of Moses. We've heard of him. He plays a very prominent role in our story, although if you read the Haggadah, you'd be scratching your head. He's nowhere to be found. Another time, another place we can talk about it. But the fact is, Moshe, what happens? The Torah tells us he's born early, his mom's able to hide him for a few months, puts him in the basket, goes down the river, daughter of Pharaoh takes him in, grows up in the palace, comes outside, sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, kills the Egyptian. Next day comes out, sees two Jews fighting. Oh, what are you going to do to us? Oh, what you did to him yesterday? He knows his goose is cooked. He flees, becomes a fugitive before Harrison Ford, and he goes and he's a fugitive and he runs to Midian, and there he meets the shepherds of the daughter, right? The daughters of Yisro are being bullied. Super Moshe to the rescue, saves them, gives them to drink. They come home early. Why are you home so early? Dad asks. Oh, well, an Egyptian man saved us. What? Invite him in, dude. It's a potential son-in-law. We got this. Great. Comes in, fine, marries Tzipora. He's shepherding. Fast forward, he's out shepherding the flock. And he sees the burning bush. And this is pivotal. At the burning bush, God calls to him. And he says to him, you the man. He says, Moses, I want you to go down to Egypt. I have heard the cries of the Jewish people, and the time has come. What would you say? Craig, if you were there, and you're Moses, and you heard this, what would you say?
What, what, me?
No, I want to hear what Craig's going to say.
Moses is like, why is this being put on me?
That's what you would say? I don't believe it for a second.
I'd say,
you
sure,
would
no
say,
problem.
Yes. You would say, sure. Bring it on. I am ready to do this.
He would say, he's not talking about me.
Come on, you're a leader. You would jump right at the opportunity. Moshe. Me? Not my me? Not. And he gets you into a whole debate. I mean, just pause and think about that for a moment. Moshe is debating God about leadership to take the Jewish people out. Seriously. It's not like God was asking him for a building campaign here. Well, what's he putting up such a fight about? He doesn't feel worthy. What about my brother? I have a this, I got a that. Oh, my back and oh, my knees are acting up recently. What kind of debate is this? If you read that debate carefully, guess what? How many questions does Moshe ask of God? Yeah, the answer is going to be 4. It's the exact same scenario. Moshe debating God and asking God questions? Like what? The answer is, Moshe is not debating God. I know this is contrary to what we always learned. I'm giving you another perspective. Moshe is not debating God. He knows this is his mission. But he knows from the story of what Hashem did at the Garden of Eden, after there was a mistake, the way to rectify, to inspire the redemption, so to say, requires asking 4 questions. The same way God did after Adam and Eve, that's how he got out of the trouble. Then Moshe says, I'm going to do the same thing. Moshe's now implementing his leadership, and he's imitating God by asking 4 questions to get out of Mitzrayim. Every Seder night, we sit down and we remind ourselves. There's a fabulous phrase in the Talmud. The Talmud tells us, "Benisan nigalu," in the month of Nisan, our ancestors were redeemed. "Benisan asidin ligael," in the month of Nisan, they will again in the future be redeemed. What does that mean in practical terms? Obviously, we want and believe that Mashiach can come at any moment. But there are certain times of the year that are more auspicious for it than others. The month that is most prone for redemption for the Jewish people is the month of Nisan, this month that we are in now. I always tell you this, I'm not a prophet. I do not get personal messages from God. I don't. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you. But I don't. Okay? I do not know. But it's a feeling. I think anybody with their eyes open and is looking what's going on in the world has to wonder, are we on the cusp of redemption? There's too many things flying right now. It's crazy. I don't know. But this is the month. The Talmud says, in the month of Nisan, they were redeemed. In the month of Nisan, they are destined to be redeemed again. He wanted to suggest, the author of this piece suggests, that that is perhaps the reasoning behind why the theme of the night, if you have to pick a number that represents the Seder night, it's the number 4. 4 children, 4 question, 4 cups of wine. There's so many 4s. Perhaps he suggests that it is indicating this concept of the 4 questions that represent the redemption from trouble. But I'll show you. There's so much more to this because I'm a big Garden of Eden guy. Oh, man. Let's talk about this for a moment. Where did Adam and Eve live? Be very specific. When they were created, they were put where?
Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Eden. Were they put in Eden proper? Huh. Now you're wondering. I never thought about that. This is the Garden of Eden.
Ooh.
Is there a place called Eden? If this is the Garden of. I never thought about that. Yeah. I think I can end the class right here. We got what to talk about. It's called the Garden of Eden. In fact, there must have been a place called Eden, but that's not where they were. They were not in there. They were only, unquote, quote unquote, only in the Garden of Eden, which was quite a utopic society, right? What an amazing place. But it's not Eden itself. The Torah tells us that they were in the middle of describing the Garden of Eden with all kinds of trees and the special two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, In the middle of all of this, it talks about a river. A river that issues forth from Eden to water the Garden of Eden. Does that sound vaguely familiar? Great. I don't have to show you the verse. Excellent. So you knew already there's a place called Eden that the river issues forth from and waters the Garden of Eden. Okay. Interesting trivia again. My goal at the end of life is to make sure that all my students can win Jewish Trivial Pursuit. So you now have another piece of information. Fine. Okay. But the Torah tells us that that river that ran through the Garden of Eden, something unique. It tells us some interesting attribute about it. What happens? It divides.
Splits.
It divides into four headwaters.
Four
rivers. Four. Like I'm telling you, you can't make this stuff up, folks. It divides into four directions, if you want. Okay? And it says, the Zohar says, many of the books, that every natural body of water today has its roots. If you were to follow it back somehow, which you can't do, follow it all the way back, you would get to the Garden of Eden. It works its way back there. That's its source. Okay? The Garden of Eden represents that perfect balance prior to the sin, the balance between physical and spiritual, correct? That was what the Garden of Eden was like prior to them sinning. Okay. So they're going to need some way to always refer back to it and connect back to it. This, by the way, not for tonight, this is the concept of going to a mikvah. Going to a mikvah is using natural water taken from a natural body that never was touched that way, and therefore you are immersing yourself in the pristine waters that have its source all the way back in the Garden of Eden. But fine. We find four throughout creation. There are four stages of creation. There are, even in regular science, there's four categories. You have inanimate objects, you have vegetative, you have animal, and you have human. There's four different. And how about the world itself? There's four elements. Earth, air, fire, and water. There's fours throughout creation. There's four stages of Mashiach's era. Again, I'm not going to go through all of these. How about the Torah itself? We always talk about the Torah can be understood as Pardes. Pardes literally means the orchard, but it stands for the four levels of Torah understanding. Pei stands for Pshat, understanding, the simple storyline. Then comes Resh, Remez, hint, allusions to things. Then comes Drush, the fancy English word, exegesis, of where they go ahead and they learn out things the way verses are phrased and different spellings. And then you have Samach Esod, secrets, Kabbalah. It's four. There's always four. The Torah is understood on that. Everything about this is all about fours. Okay? Four cups of wine, four questions, four sons, four mitzvos that we perform the night of Pesach. Matzah, maror, telling over the story of Haggadah, and the four cups of wine. There's the four mitzvos of the night. But wait, I'll even say, oh, but isn't there a three? What's a three of the Pesach night?
Matzos.
Three matzos, right? Rabbi, they got it wrong. Should be four matzos. Everything else is fours. No. I'm glad you asked. Thank you, Michelle. Exactly. Don't we in the very beginning take the middle matzah and split it? Now you got four. The theme of the night is all about fours. Perhaps, based on what we're saying tonight, the reasoning is because the origin of questions that were brought into the world was in a negative connotation, where the serpent tried to entice and unfortunately was successful with planting doubts about God's mastery, about God's commandment to Adam and Eve. And the only way to rectify it was what Hashem taught us, that you ask four questions. Delve deeper, inspire, ask yourself the hard questions, like Ayeka, where are you? When you do that and you get into the kishkes of it, you get into the meat of it, and not just superficial, yeah, whatever. Hate that term, whatever. Whatever means I don't want to think about it. Wrong answer. We need to think about it. I can't think so much. Good, so let's do it as questions and answers. Everything about this night is about questions and answers. And it's built on these four questions that God asked of Adam and Eve way back in the Garden of Eden, that was there to act as an impetus and an inspiration for them to get their act together, realize their mistakes, and pull themselves up by the bootstraps and start making amends for the mistake. That is the reminder every Seder night. I had never heard this before. I had never even contemplated this idea of the four questions that represented the four questions. This was all brand new to me. You are the very first people to hear of this. Do not share it with anyone until Seder night, because they may end up at my Seder. And if they come and they tell me they heard this, I'm coming after you. Questions, thoughts? I mean, it's a fascinating concept. Go ahead, Robin.
I'm sorry, just because I have not recently studied Garden of Eden as much as you have. So
What are you doing tomorrow night?
Yeah, I'm going to focus on that now. But the four questions that they asked, were Adam and Eve really honest about their answers?
They weren't given too many options.
I don't remember what they said. I mean, when they said, where are you? We said, I'm here. But then the rest of them, what did
they
say?
Well, they were honest. No, they were honest. God asked them, right? He said, where are you? Adam said, I heard the sound of you in the garden. I was afraid because I'm naked, so I hid. I'm not going to lie and say, I was out shopping for coconuts. You know, I was looking for a good fig leaf. Why? I don't know. David, I heard there was a sale on fig leaves that day. He didn't make some booba myself. He was honest. He said, I was afraid because I knew that I messed up. That's how I know I'm naked. God said, oh, yeah. Is it because you ate from the tree you weren't supposed to? So he didn't give a totally great answer. He said, the woman you gave me, she gave to me. He passed the buck a little bit, and he's held accountable for that. But there were answers, and then God says, okay, there's repercussions to your mistake. But the point is that God didn't just come down with a bolt of lightning. He engaged Adam and Eve in questions so that they can look within themselves and see, you know, you're right. I made a mistake. Okay, now let's fix it. But that only comes about when you can do an introspection. And the best way to do that is by asking the hard questions.
That helps a little bit. I didn't remember. I knew they were honest, but I didn't think they were entirely. So I wasn't sure. I wanted to kind of.
You're good. It's all good. Susan, I know it's not Kabbalistic, but it's pretty cool.
I'm delighted because, you know, so much of my studies with you over a very long time, we always get back to the garden.
I don't plan it that way. I really don't.
But it's you must have just been thrilled.
This was a very cool insight for me. Never heard it before. Any other questions, thoughts?
Rabbi.
Yes.
You'll be pleased to know, when I opened up this book, this piece of paper came out. I don't know if you can see it.
Four sons, Passover. Oh, there it is. Ask. I saw the word asks is underlined.
And then with the It says the word, I underlined ask, and then on the wicked it said underlined statement.
There you go.
Not a question.
There you go.
But now I'm going to add the questions of the Garden of Eden. I'm going to talk about what was the first question and what were the four questions from. I'm going to add more to it.
I love it. Great. I love the fact that you have notes on this. Great. Perfect.
Is there an Eden?
Of course there's an Eden.
Here.
Sorry. Can't tell you.
Can I look it up?
Nobody's ever been there. No human being has ever been in Eden yet. That's Adam and Eve were put in Garden of Eden. No can do yet. Maybe another time we'll talk about it. But no. Nope. Nobody's ever seen it.
But it's Rabbi, I'm thinking there's another connection between going back to the Garden of Eden and Pesach and our story, which is that this is a story about exile, correct? And it's as if the slaves were their capacity for awareness was in exile for 400 years because they're just in survival mode. They didn't even, if you're not aware, if you've always been a slave and nothing else,
right?
You know, and so, and in similar way, that the question that Hashem is posing to them, which of course he knows the answer to where they were, also underscores that his upset that they were blessed with this balance and awareness and da'at, and it went into exile at the moment that they made that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. The concept of physically being in exile is only one half of the equation. There's a counterpart, and that is the spiritual aspect of
it. Absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, it's not for tonight, but they talk about the fact that how did we finally get out is that we cried out to Hashem finally. Think about that. For 400 years, you know, we didn't cry out to God. How did that not happen? Well, so they say because we became so accustomed to the circumstances, we just assume that's the way it is. In fact, they say that the name of the holiday, Pesach, is a contraction of two words. Pe, the mouth, sach, converses. This is the holiday that allows us or showed us the ability for us to express vocally what our feelings were and how we missed having the relationship with God. Pesach, the mouth that speaks. Everything, I mean, again, it could be a whole nother whole lecture, a whole discussion, we don't do lectures, of the theme of the holiday. What's the name of the book we use? Haggadah. What does Haggadah mean? To tell over. It's about telling over the story. Everything, I mean, what's the other example? Oh, how about Paro's name? How did Paro enslave us in the first place? How did he pull that off? I mean, we were members of society. Joseph had been second in command and he died and next Pharaoh. How did we all of a sudden become slaves? It didn't happen overnight. So the Midrash tells us that Paro was a tremendous orator and he got everybody inspired and everybody should come and help and build and we're going to make Egypt the best society and everybody, Egyptians and Jews, everybody. And then slowly but surely, he started pulling back. Okay, we got to get the doctors back and doing medical practice. So all the Egyptian doctors go back there. And all that, and, you know, it's almost like, you know, everybody's in a line and then everybody but one guy takes one step back. Oh, okay, you're it, right? We got stuck in the same spot. Look at the name Paro. Paro, in his core, was an evil person, very wicked. But he had an ability to couch that wickedness with the way he spoke. He was a fantastic, using an analogy more modern history, that's what Hitler was. Hitler was a tremendous orator. He inspired the masses. But in his core, it was with an evil intent. But he didn't come out right and say it. He couched it with words and he couched it with ideas. The name Paro, if you spell it out, He, Resh, Ayin, He. The outer letters, He and He, spell the word Peh, mouth. The two inner letters, the core, Resh, Ayin, is Ra, evil. It's the root in the core is the evilness, but it's couched with the way he spoke. So the holiday of Pesach is the counter to where he used the words to deny God. We reached out and affirmed God. Whatever, another whole conversation. I can just keep pushing buttons. Just keep asking questions, we'll get another one. We can be here till 2 a.m. We could practice for the Seder. Okay, fair enough. All right, everybody have a Chag Kosher V'Sameach, a beautiful Yom Tov, an uplifting, inspiring one together, and that I hope and I pray that this is, if we're not there by Monday night, if we're not back in Israel by Monday night, that this be the last one that we have here in the exile, and that next year, when we sit and we have our Zoom class, we're going to be doing it from the comfort of our homes in Jerusalem with the new Beit HaMikdash, and we're going to have so much more Torah to discuss because we're going to have the Pesach offering and all the other stuff that we don't have. We got a lot to learn. So if we're not in Jerusalem this year, then our bracha, our hope and our prayer that we say at the Seder is L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, let next year be in Jerusalem. We'll do our class. Maybe we'll do it in person at that point because we'll all be in the same neighborhood. Sounds great to me. Have a wonderful, wonderful Yom Tov, and I will see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All right?
Thank you.
Fabulous.
Thank you, Rabbi. Sharon.